Hello and welcome to Volume 46, Number 8 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 20th of February 2026. I'm Graham, your presenter, joined this week by newsreaders Andy and Margaret. And in the news, the County Council is in uproar. The Town Hall is a top venue. And see what's happening to the Winter Gardens. In Grapevine Extra this week, Desney and Andrew welcome a guest from Radio Norfolk to the studio. First, though, we've got a birthday. Yes, Carol Fellas is the recipient of our best wishes this week as she celebrates on Thursday the 26th. Have a great time, Carol. Okay, time for the first part of the news, so over to Margaret and Andy.
And now we have this week's news, and it's Andrew and Margaret, and for once I'm starting. Lawyers representing the Great Yarmouth MP have urged the High Court to block a watchdog for him investigating a complaint against him, saying it has the potential to end his career. Submissions to the court on behalf of Rupert Lowe have claimed a probe into his alleged conduct by the Independent Complaints and Grievance Scheme, known as the ICGS, is procedurally unfair and that it could lead to unjust harm. The independent Great Yarmouth MP is asking the High Court to temporarily halt the investigation until a full court hearing about the issue can take place next month. Details of the complaint remain unknown, but it is understood it was made in July last year and likely will have come from either an MP, a former MP, or a parliamentary staff member. The watchdog is responsible for investigating complaints relating to bullying, harassment, and/or sexual misconduct within Parliament. In written submissions, Christopher Newman, representing Mr. Lowe, said, "The substantive claim to judicial review alleges procedural unfairness in the processes of the ICGS, as well as perversity and illegality. The scope for unjust harm arising from an adjudicative process, in this case one which has the potential to end the career of a Member of Parliament, being infected by bias is very significant." Mr. Lowe is asking the court to quash the decision to investigate him, which came following a complaint made to the ICGS by a third party who cannot be identified. A full hearing of the challenge is due to be heard next month, but this week lawyers for Mr. Lowe are asking the High Court to temporarily block the watchdog from investigating the complaint pending the outcome of the March hearing. Mr. Newman added, "There is already troubling evidence of corruption of process unfairly affecting Mr. Lowe. There is a powerful inference that the complainant leaked information to Reform UK, which led Reform UK starting its own fact-finding process." But lawyers for the ICGS said in written submissions that Mr. Lowe is a sitting MP subject to the rules, procedures and standards of behaviour for members of the House of Commons. Sarah Hanna for the ICGS said, "Most fundamentally, the claimant is answerable to the House about the allegations of misconduct made against him. They're not for the court." While the nature of the allegations against Mr. Lowe are unclear, he has previously faced complaints about his conduct. He was suspended from Reform after being accused of making threats of violence towards the then party chairman, Zia Yusuf. Mr. Lowe denied the allegations, and the Crown Prosecution Service said no criminal charges would be brought against him. Having been booted out of Reform, Mr. Lowe is now an independent. But he has recently announced his political movement, called Restore Britain, will become a new political party. Mr. Justice Chamberlain is due to give his decision on the matter on February 24th.
Hello everyone, it's the other Margaret here, and this is my first news item, so if you're sitting comfortably, I'll begin. An East Anglian bed retailer has opened a new store in Yarmouth. World of Beds, which has locations in Norwich, Dereham and Bury St Edmunds, has opened its latest bed and mattress store in Theatre Plain. The family-run retailer has been helping customers find a place to lay their heads for 40 years. Steve Blunston, owner of the World of Beds, said, "Buying a bed is personal. It's not just a product, it's how you feel every day. Our new Great Yarmouth store is all about giving customers the time, care and expertise to choose properly, with options to try in-store and get honest advice." To celebrate the opening, World of Beds is offering 10% off at its Great Yarmouth store. It's also offering 0% finance to help customers spread the cost of their purchase.
And some news with the Winter Gardens. People have the chance to explore behind the scenes and look to the future of one of the area's most distinctive buildings. The £19 million restoration of the Winter Gardens in the town is gathering pace. As the Grade 2 listed Victorian venue is transformed, people will have the chance to see an exciting piece of Great Yarmouth's future as a series of guided site tours are held next month. The Victorian landmark on Marine Parade closed in 2008 after safety fears. After falling into disrepair, works to bring the building back to life started late last year. The restoration is set to include many of the original features, including cast and wrought iron ironwork, and lost details of timber screens to recapture its past grandeur. The landmark on the Golden Mile, located next to Wellington Pier, is set to become a so-called People's Palace, with cafes and community spaces when it reopens in 2028. But now, Great Yarmouth Borough Council is offering a chance to see the latest progress at the site as part of National Lottery Open Week. The tours are being held three times daily on Thursday, March the 5th, Friday, March the 6th and Saturday, March the 7th at 9:30 a.m, 11 a.m and 1 p.m. Booking is essential online via Great Yarmouth Heritage Guide Tours on the Council's website. The Council said, "Join us for Explore the Future of the Winter Gardens and enjoy a guided site tour led by the main contractor, where you'll discover the building's fascinating past, see the incredible transformation taking place, and learn how it's being restored for future generations to enjoy." The Winter Gardens is the UK's last surviving Victorian glasshouse on a seaside promenade. Over the decades, it was used for roller skating, ballroom dancing, an amusement arcade, and for many years it was themed as a German beer garden.
A local wedding venue has been named among the best of its kind in the UK. The wedding planning app Bridebook has released its 10th annual UK wedding report. It saw thousands of engaged and newlywed couples quizzed about their attitudes to weddings and tracked the best reviewed registered office wedding venues. Great Yarmouth Town Hall came out in second place with 24 five-star reviews on Bridebook. A spokeswoman for Bridebook said, "Great Yarmouth's beautifully refurbished town hall is arguably the town's most prestigious wedding venue. The elegance and grandeur of the Grade 2 listed building will ensure guests are instantly impressed by the unique Renaissance-style architecture, elevating the sense of occasion for any couple's special day. Additionally, the magnificent oak staircase with its spectacular stained glass window backdrop is a sight to behold and provides a perfect backdrop for all those important wedding photographs. Some of the reviews branded it a wonderful and elegant sight and complimented the beautiful function room. The Kensington and Chelsea Register office came out top with 53 five-star reviews, and the Guildhall in Salisbury won bronze in third place with 17 five-star reviews.
And staying with weddings, a great Yarmouth business owner has won an outstanding achievement award in a national competition. Helen Garrett, 48, who owns Creative Decorations based in Yarmouth, won the Outstanding Achievement Award at the Nation's Wedding Awards 2026. Her business creates balloon arches and displays for weddings, birthday parties and special events. Mrs. Garrett said, "I bring fun to people's weddings and parties. A party with no decorations is just a meeting. I like the fun side of it. You should always have a reason to party. It brings more fun into it." She was shortlisted for the award and then sent in supporting evidence before she got the news that she had triumphed. Mrs. Garrett, originally from Bedfordshire, set up her business 15 years ago in her home county. She moved to Great Yarmouth 3 years ago, and since then has made a name for herself in the decorations world. Her business providing decorations for 5 weddings last year, and since the setup of her business, she's worked on more than 50 weddings. You will be able to meet the award winner and other local businesses at the wedding fair in the Royal Assembly Rooms in Great Yarmouth on Sunday, March the 1st, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Following previous reports, it has been announced that 2 new special educational needs schools will be built in Norfolk after the government confirmed £40 million in funding for the sites. Norfolk County Council has said it will press ahead with building the facilities in Downham Market and Great Yarmouth, which will support 270 children. The schools will be led by Unity Trust in Great Yarmouth and Eastern Learning Alliance in Downham Market. Penny Carpenter, Cabinet Member for Children's Services at Norfolk County Council, said, "The schools mean that more children with special educational needs will be able to learn near their homes, and that is at the heart of our strategy to improve learning for children with additional needs. We know that most children can flourish in mainstream schools with the right support. But for those with more complex needs, there is still a need for specialist places like these." Terry Jeremy, MP for South West Norfolk, praised the move. He said, "For too long, West Norfolk has suffered from a lack of SEND support, leaving children either having to travel huge distances to access an education or stuck in an entirely unsuitable setting that doesn't meet their specific needs, or not accessing an education at all. Today's announcement will change that."
Tea rooms have reopened at a key attraction in the town after undergoing renovation work. The tea rooms at Merivale Model Village have reopened to the public after a major revamp was completed. A Facebook post from the Model Village said, "We're officially back open. Our newly renovated tea rooms are ready to welcome you, and we can't wait for you to come and enjoy them. We've updated our menu with gluten-free, vegetarian and vegan options, alongside a delicious selection of fresh cakes and our usual quality teas and coffee. And just in time for the colder days, heating just installed, so you can stay cosy while you visit. Pop in, relax and enjoy the space. We'd love to see you." The new cafe and tea rooms will be run by the owners of the Model Village. It comes after Christopher's Tea Rooms, a family-run business which had been based in Marine Parade for 21 years, closed in November. The Merivale Model Village first opened in 1961, and in addition to the tea rooms, has a crazy golf course and an old penny arcade.
A probe launched more than 2 years ago into the contact police had with a woman prior to her being murdered by her boyfriend is to be completed within months. The Independent Office for Police Conduct, IOPC, started an investigation following the discovery of the body of Tara Kershaw, 33, at her flat in Great Yarmouth on January the 20th, 2024. In November 2024, her partner, Adam Barnard, then 41, was convicted of murdering Miss Kershaw following a five-week trial at Norwich Crown Court. He was sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum term of 19 years. The IOPC has said the probe is expected to conclude in the spring. The inquiry has multiple incidents under consideration, with a total of six officers or staff members having been served with conduct notices. This includes a member of police staff and a former police officer being investigated for potential gross misconduct, and a further four officers are being investigated for potential misconduct. The 2024 trial heard Miss Kershaw died from compression of the neck, with a post-mortem examination revealing evidence of two episodes of previous fractures to the larynx or voice box. Jurors also heard Barnard, who lived next door to Miss Kershaw in a guest house on Prince's Road, was arrested on January the 18th, 2024, after she told police he had cut her lip. He was taken into custody and interviewed, telling officers she had caused the cut herself. He was released shortly after 11 p.m. on January the 18th, 2024, with no further action taken, and returned to the guest house, where he killed Miss Kershaw hours later. Before Barnard was bailed, Miss Kershaw's family told her the mother of two had been let down by police and other agencies in moving victim impact statements. Tanita Sala said she had suffered an unbearable loss of not only her sister, but best friend. She said, "Unfortunately, no matter how many times she cried out for help, saying how scared she was never believed by those who should have protected her. She knew Adam would one day kill her. We all know it could have been avoided if the professionals had listened to her outcry instead of ignoring her because of her drinking."
Great Yarmouth Borough Council has approved plans to convert Oswald House in Great Yarmouth into a detached block of six three-bedroom townhouses. The plan, submitted by Mr. Dacres, will see the existing building, which had been used as an office and residential building, turned into four townhouses. Two additional townhouses will be built at either end of the building, located at 284-285 South Town Road. The existing residential extension to the rear of Oswald House will be demolished. Anglian Water objected to the plans, raising concerns about how surface water will be discharged. It also objected to any connection into its wastewater network, citing capacity constraints and pollution risk. Each townhouse will have en-suites, open-plan living areas with balconies, and ground floor garden rooms opening onto rear-facing gardens. The site currently has 12 car parking spaces, and these will be retained at the front by South Town Road. Each home will also have access to a garage. Red-facing brick will be used on the walls of the development, while slate will be used on the roof. During the last century, the building was, for many years, a branch of Watson's Garages, and the head office for the Caister Group, who at the time owned Caister Holiday Camp, plus Silver Sands and Seashore Caravan Camps, and several hotels in Yarmouth and Lowestoft.
A banned street drinker has been jailed for repeatedly breaching an antisocial behaviour order. David Steventon, who is often seen in a wheelchair in Great Yarmouth, was sentenced to 16 weeks in prison after violating an injunction. Issued in November 2024, the order barred him from parts of Great Yarmouth and Gorleston town centres as his street drinking and behaviour was causing a nuisance to the public. The 58-year-old had been a regular presence outside the Sports Direct store and more recently in the doorway of a former cash and carry in King Street. Despite support from multiple agencies, including help securing accommodation where alcohol use was permitted, Steventon continued to breach the terms of the order. Steventon, who has no fixed address, was convicted of 7 breaches of the order by Great Yarmouth Magistrates Court. District Judge Spencer described him as a significant public nuisance, noting the absence of mitigating circumstances and his repeated disregard for court orders. The judge also awarded the council £7,138.68 in costs. If he breaches the order again after his release, he could be arrested. Councillor Paul Wells said, "Our officers, the police and a number of other organisations have worked extremely hard to assist the defendant. However, all these interventions have failed, and it was important we brought this prosecution to protect the public. Where necessary, we will use all the legal tools at our disposal to take appropriate action. Residents have repeatedly made clear they want a clean, safe and welcoming town, and where antisocial behaviour is affecting that, we will act."
And another story of housing. Gorleston community is outraged over plans to build bungalows on what residents call the last truly wild place in the Norfolk town. Great Yarmouth Borough Council says they want to build sheltered houses for older people on land in Gorleston between the town's recreation ground and Meadow Park. But the scheme has incensed residents who are appalled about the potential loss of wildlife. The land is owned by the council and was once part of allotments which closed in the 1990s. Since then it has become home to apple and cherry trees, blackberry and gooseberry bushes, as well as foxes, bats, hedgehogs and muntjac deer. The council says they have secured government funding to carry out surveys to see if the land is suitable for a small sheltered housing scheme of 1- and 2-bedroom bungalows. They say there are no designs yet for the houses and that once the surveys are complete, there'll be a public consultation. The community, however, has accused the council of ignoring them and attempting to force through the plans. A petition to save the woodland, launched last year after the council's local plan allocated the site for up to 70 houses, has attracted more than 1,500 people and the backing of local MP Rupert Lowe. Jess Rogers, who has been leading the campaign, said, "The council is supposed to be serving the community, but they're refusing to listen. We're proud of the place and we want to look after it. We're really keen to preserve it for generations to come." Over the past year, the community has organised clean-ups at the woodland, removing 100 bags and 2 skips worth of rubbish, including fly-tipped material. Ms Rogers says she has drawn up a proposal for the area, which would include clearing pathways and access, but the council will not meet her. The council's announcement about the proposal prompted a cascade of comments on social media, not one of them supporting the plans. The chief concern is the loss of wildlife, with locals describing the place as the last pocket of woodland in Gorleston. They say they use the land for dog walking and quiet walks. One said, "It's a beautiful place to walk to get away from the hustle and bustle for a bit, and good for people's mental health, as you can explore, forget or think for a minute." Some say there's already enough housing from Bradwell to Hopton, while others have accused the council of pretending to listen whilst ignoring the residents. The council say that providing houses for people who want to downsize can free up family homes nearby. They also said that any future development would meet strict environmental standards, including improving diversity by at least 10%. Residents, however, have mocked the idea that you can increase biodiversity by building over an existing wildlife habitat.
The leader of Norfolk County Council has declined to say whether she intends to stand for re-election amid her extraordinary row with the government over its decision to reinstate the vote. Kay Mason-Billig has been embroiled in a furious war of words with Steve Reed, the local government secretary, since his U-turn on Monday when he announced the elections would go ahead in May. He said the vote would be cancelled to allow more time for his department's reorganisation of local government. Ms Mason-Billig had declined to oppose the postponement, although she had not explicitly supported it. After the U-turn was announced, she launched a stinging attack on Mr Reed, calling him a two-faced bully. She said he had threatened her with withdrawing funding from the county if she spoke out against the postponement, and said her council no longer wanted to be involved in the devolution process. In response, government sources accused her of vile abuse and said her claims were untrue. When approached by the EDP, she defended her explosive remarks. "I do stand by my comments," she said. "I have been entirely honest about the situation we have been put in and what went on behind the scenes, with this government trying to force us to do their dirty work and take the blame for it." The row has put her position in the spotlight, with opponents criticising the way she has handled the debacle, and she said, "I will let you know about whether I will stand or not." Ms Mason-Billig's response to the U-turn has left both the process of local government reform, LGR, which would have seen Norfolk's county and district councils replaced by unitary ones, and the creation of the cross-county mayor uncertain.
Don't forget our special studio guest in Grapevine Extra coming up later. Now, though, a few items of news in brief.
Herring Bridge in Great Yarmouth will be shut to traffic from 8 p.m. on February 24th until 6 a.m. the following morning. Signed diversion routes via Haven Bridge have been arranged for the duration. Pedestrian and cycle access will remain unaffected, while river traffic will also flow as usual. The County Council apologised for any inconvenience and expressed appreciation for drivers' patience while this work was carried out. The bridge's closure is to allow routine maintenance to be carried out. Caister Beach car park will close from Tuesday 24th to Saturday February 28th, while it is used by a production company. A spokeswoman for Great Yarmouth Borough Council said, "Yes, this will be closed on the dates advertised. Plans are still being developed, so we're unable to share further details at this time at the request of the production company." The council will receive a licence fee for the use of the land, and this fee will be used to fund pothole repairs on the site. The Bewilder boats at Bewilderwood will not be running during half term due to an unexpected issue with the fleet. The Adventure Park in Hoveton has been running the boat trips around the lake since 2007, when the park first opened. It has remained a key feature of the attraction, taking visitors on a journey to hear the story of Swampy the Marsh Bogle. A spokesman for Bewilderwood said, "We've tried to make the visitors aware of this issue. We're very sorry for any inconvenience. The good news is, we're planning to have them back up and running for the Easter holidays." Nearly 500 pancakes were served up at a lively family gathering. The pancake party, held at St Mary Magdalene Church in Gorston, took place this week and saw children, parents and grandparents enjoy an afternoon filled with food, games and crafts. The entertainment included a pancake tossing competition, pancake races and a creative session provided by local arts organisation Freshly Grated. Reverend Matthew Price, vicar of St Mary Magdalene Church, said, "It was wonderful to see so many families enjoying time together. The laughter during the pancake races and the tossing competition was brilliant. As a church, we believe community really matters." We're so grateful to our volunteers and to Freshly Grated for helping make it such a special afternoon.
And these are my news items in brief. Police are still hunting for a man as part of a probe into the use of counterfeit cash in Great Yarmouth. The investigation began after a person went to an address in the town and handed over £300 in fake notes in exchange for a PlayStation. Police later released an image of a man who may have information that could help their inquiries, asking anyone who recognises him to contact officers on 101. The fire service has pleaded for drivers to park more considerately, as every second counts when they're on their way to an emergency. A new statement issued by Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service has reminded motorists to leave enough space for fire engines to pass when they park. It also urged people to check that their vehicle is not blocking any fire hydrants. This is not the first time Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service has had to issue a plea of this nature. In July 2024, the warning was accompanied by a series of images of parking which caused problems for crews on rural roads in particular. A villager's post office has temporarily closed its doors. The branch at the Premier store in the street at Blowfield shut on Friday, February the 6th. Wendy Hamilton, area change manager, said the team is working to restore post office services at Blowfield. She also said, "In the interim, we hope that our customers will continue to use post office services. The nearest post office is just over a mile away at the Co-op in the street, Brundle. It offers us the same services as well as a range of travel money, vehicle tax and on-demand travel insurance services." A car was stopped by police after multiple children were spotted not wearing seat belts. It happened in Great Yarmouth on Monday after officers saw four children unrestrained on the rear seats. They had no seat belts, no car seats, and one of the older children was holding a baby. A spokesman for Norfolk Constabulary said, "This is a sight our officers never want to see. Seat belts and the appropriate car seat are not optional. They are essential for keeping children safe. In a collision, even at low speeds, an unrestrained child can be thrown forward with enormous force, leading to life-changing injuries or worse. Drivers can be fined up to £500 if a child under 14 is not in the correct car seat or is not wearing a seat belt."
Right, it's time for Andy and Margaret to get you fully up to date with the rest of this week's local news.
Almost 9 in 10 private business owners in the east of England are confident about achieving growth this year, according to KPMG's annual Private Enterprise Barometer. In total, 86% of bosses in the region said they feel confident about their 2026 growth prospects, with almost two-thirds set to invest in expansion plans. The annual survey heard from around 1,500 privately owned businesses, including 125 in the east of England. More than half of firms in the east said the primary driver of their confidence is an increased demand for their products and services. Two-fifths said they plan to invest in new technology this year, with over a third prioritising AI. Nearly half of businesses said Eastern Europe was their favoured destination for trade and expansion. Joe Faulkner, East Anglia Office Senior Partner at KPMG UK, said, what is really evident is the resilience of private businesses across the east of England. Even against a challenging global and domestic backdrop, firms are feeling positive about their growth prospects and are taking a proactive approach to the future. The focus on technology, data and diversification shows a region that isn't standing still, but actively investing to stay competitive and seize new opportunities. This ambition is exemplified by the Oxford-Cambridge Arc, which has the potential to be the key turning point for the east of England that connects 3 million people across one of the UK's most highly skilled labour markets, significantly bolstering the region's growth and capabilities and giving it the scale and confidence to rival the world's leading business hubs, especially in technology and life sciences. This, alongside the critical role other parts of the region play in areas like energy infrastructure, national and international logistics, agritech and fintech, give our business leaders a clear long-term rationale for optimism and investment.
And this is a follow-on from my last news item. The government has hit back at the leader of Norfolk County Council after she sensationally withdrew the authority from the devolution process, accusing her of vile abuse and false accusations. Kay Mason-Billig, the Conservative leader at County Hall, has been criticised following her extraordinary speech on Tuesday, where she branded local government secretary Steve Reid a two-faced bully. She made the remarks after he reversed his previous decision to cancel this spring's local elections and said they could go ahead after all. Ms Mason-Billig claimed he had earlier threatened to restrict the county's access to funding and to withhold certain powers from the proposed devolved authorities unless she agreed to support a delay in the elections. In response to his U-turn, she announced that her authority would be pulling out of the Labour's flagship policy of reorganising local councils and creating a mayor for the region, claiming there would now not be enough time to complete the process. The decision has enraged the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government. A source at the department said, "It's both baffling and shocking that a council leader would launch such vile abuse and totally false accusations at a Secretary of State she has, by her own admission, never met or spoken to. She should reflect on her own leadership, given her inability over recent weeks to communicate a clear position on election delays." Labour has also criticised Ms Mason-Billig, reviving the Stakegate scandal from last summer, when the Tory leader was criticised over her Facebook post, which showed a picture of her steak meal with the caption, "Wonder what all the poor people are doing." The post, which she claimed was a private joke, infuriated many in her own party, and she was overlooked as the Tories' candidate to be the first mayor of Norfolk and Suffolk. A Labour spokesman said, "The Tories in Norfolk are set to reject £1 billion over government investment over 30 years, all because she's scared of losing her seat." The government's response marks the latest escalation in the ill-tempered row, which has spiralled since Monday's U-turn on election postponements. In her speech at a full council meeting at County Hall on Tuesday, Ms Mason-Billig said that the government's handling of elections and devolution had thrown a decade of work down the pan. She called on district councils to support her decision to withdraw from the devolution process, which the Tory leaders of South Norfolk and Great Yarmouth have since done.
Around 1,000 extra engineering construction workers will be needed in the east of England by the end of the decade to build major products like Sizewell C and new offshore wind farms, the chief executive of the industry's training board has said. Andrew Hockey, CEO of the Engineering Construction Industry Training Board, said the sector desperately needs new talent, with the region's workforce forecasted to be increased by 12% in the next 5 years. But the industry is facing a skills shortage, with 60% of employers in the East experiencing challenges hiring skilled workers, with more than a third of the area's workforce now over 50. As one of the core industrial cluster hotspots, the East of England already employs large numbers in the ECI sectors, such as nuclear, oil and gas, renewables, food and drink processing, and water treatment, Mr. Hockey said. With this growing demand for skilled workers comes opportunities for young people, particularly in East Anglia, to embark on careers that can make a real difference in an industry that will be critical to achieve net zero. These opportunities exist in trades such as mechanical and electrical engineers, scaffolders, project managers, pipe fitters and welders, to name but a few. To combat the skills, the Training Board has developed a range of initiatives to create pathways into the industry for new entrants and young people. The ECITB scholarship has been producing new talent for over 5 years, supporting the next generation of workers at centres such as at Regit in Norwich and East Coast College in Lowestoft. Learners pursue a full-time, off-the-job programme over 1 or 2 years and receive a weekly learner allowance. On successful completion of the programme, scholars have industry-standard qualifications, relevant site training and invaluable on-site experience, coupled with a clear understanding of what is expected of them when they enter industry, all of which enhances their employment prospects. The UK's engineering construction workforce could total more than 135,000 workers by 2030 to meet the demand, an increase of 19% on the current number of workers in the industry.
A primary school has been named one of just 15 Heritage Champion schools across the country. North Dean's Primary School in Great Yarmouth received the title from Historic England through its Heritage Schools programme, which supports schools in embedding local history and heritage into the curriculum. Topics explored by pupils have included the town's fishing industry, the Hippodrome building, and the impact of two world wars on Great Yarmouth. Kate Argyle, Heritage Education Manager, said, "I'm delighted to recognise the school's contribution to the Heritage Schools programme. They are truly a champion heritage school." The programme aims to help children understand how their local heritage has shaped their community. Headteacher Victoria Bland said, "We're immensely proud to receive this award. It reflects the commitment of our staff and pupils to understanding and celebrating our local heritage. Our aim has always been to make history meaningful and relevant for our pupils. By exploring stories, people and places that shaped our community, we help children see how the past connects with their lives today."
The former director of Norwich City's Youth Academy is calling for greater awareness of esophageal and gastric cancers after his own diagnosis. The former Northern Ireland international footballer Sammy Morgan, whose club career saw him play for the likes of Aston Villa, Brighton and Cambridge, was diagnosed with esophageal cancer in 2015. He had visited his GP with no obvious symptoms and was referred to Prof. Bhaskar Kumar, esophageal cancer lead at Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital. After life-saving surgery and chemotherapy, Mr. Morgan is backing calls during Esophageal Cancer Awareness Month for people to be more aware of esophageal cancer, which affects the body's food pipe, and gastric cancer, which affects the stomach. Ex-striker Mr. Morgan, capped 18 times by Northern Ireland, said, "I didn't expect anything to be wrong, so the diagnosis was a real bombshell. The treatment started with chemo, then surgery, and finally chemo again. And it obviously worked, because here I am, 10 years on. I would tell anyone who's concerned to get to your GP as soon as you can. We're all a little bit inclined to put it off. I was lucky to get it caught early, and it's worked. I can't speak highly enough of the team that treated me. I feel very fortunate. Mr. Morgan, who moved from Northern Ireland to Galston at the age of 12 and played for the town's non-league side before his professional career, returned to the seaside town after his playing days came to an end. He taught at Cliff Park High School and then Lyn Grove High School and became involved in the Canary Schoolboys in 1990. His Canaries career saw him help develop the likes of Darren Eady, Jamie Kiraton, Darrell Russell, Robert Green and Ryan Jarvis, and he was the first ever director of Norwich City's Academy from 1997 until 2004. Prof Kumar, who treated Mr. Morgan, said, "Many patients are diagnosed at a late stage, largely due to delays in seeking help, when early detection is crucial. Early symptoms are often vague and can easily be mistaken for more common conditions." Prof Kumar said, "By promoting local awareness of the symptoms of this cancer, we hope more patients will seek early help, allowing us to cure them. If cases present early enough, we can cure patients often without needing chemotherapy or even major surgery. If surgery is needed, we have minimal invasive options which allow a smoother recovery."
Shocking new data has shown an alarming rise in speeding offences across Norfolk. A Freedom of Information request by the Mercury found that 10,000 more drivers were caught speeding in the county than the year before. A total of 74,839 speeders were snared in 2025, compared to 64,672 in 2024, an increase of 10,167. Of these, 22,436 speeding offences resulted in the payment of fixed penalties. The minimum penalty for speeding in the UK is a £100 fine, meaning that more than £220,000 was paid by speeding motorists in Norfolk last year. The speed limit most frequently flouted by drivers was in 30 miles per hour zones. At 38,806 confirmed captures, it made up more than a half of all speeding crimes in the county in 2025. The fastest speeding clocked was 124 miles per hour on the A149 between Dursingham and Castle Rising. It's in a 50 miles per hour zone, meaning that one speedster was driving at almost three times the limit. Making up the other fastest speeds was a driver doing 108 miles per hour on the A149 between Potterheim and Stalham, and 105 miles per hour on the A17 at King's Lynn. The camera that caught the most speeding drivers for a second year running was on the A134 at Thetford. When asked about the marked rise in speeding offences across the county year on year, a spokeswoman for Norfolk Constabulary said, "Improved communication between departments has increased detection, as well as closer joint working with the County Council to target known problem areas. Public concerns have been raised around speeding in areas not previously covered by the safety camera team, and the introduction of new camera technology has enabled more effective enforcement."
And a speeding motorist who evaded police was later found by officers at a Norfolk property where cannabis had been grown, a court has heard. Herson Mooker, 24, was spotted driving somewhat erratically by police in Great Yarmouth. Norwich Crown Court heard police followed the vehicle, which was thought to be doing up to 60 mile an hour in a 30 mile an hour zone. Richard Patterson, prosecuting, said police were forced to abort the pursuit due to concerns for public safety. Following the incident in October last year, police traced Mooker to an address in Devonshire Road in Yarmouth, where the remnants of a cannabis factory were found. Mooker, of no fixed address, appeared at court on Monday, February the 16th, after admitting dangerous driving and being concerned in the production of cannabis. He also admitted a number of other offences, including drug driving, plus driving with no insurance and without a licence. In addition, Mukher also admitted possession of cocaine in relation to offences committed in Bolton in April 2024. John Morgans, mitigating, said the dangerous driving occurred in largely an industrial area of Yarmouth. He said Mukher, who spoke through an Albanian interpreter, had come to this country 4 years ago in order to improve his life. Mukher was given a 2-year community order by recorder James Hay, who also ordered that he carry out a 15-day rehabilitation activity requirement. Mukher was also disqualified from driving for 2 years.
And yet another motoring offence. A man has been banned from driving after he got behind the wheel on the A47 in Great Yarmouth after taking cocaine and used a false number plate. Lawrence Fisher, 53, from Dagenham, Essex, appeared at Great Yarmouth Magistrates Court, where he pleaded guilty to fraudulently using a registration mark and driving with a proportion of a controlled drug over the limit. He also pleaded guilty to driving his Vauxhall without third-party insurance. Prosecuting Ellen Connolly said, on August 5, 2025, police officers were on patrol at the A47 in Great Yarmouth. Checks showed that the vehicle did not match the registration number. The false registration plate was confirmed. The driver was driving with no valid insurance. The vehicle was driven over some distance and it was also committed while under the influence of drugs. Fisher was arrested and a blood sample was taken at the police station. He has been disqualified from driving for 12 months. He must also pay a fine of £200, a victim surcharge of £80, and prosecution costs of £110.
Well, that's all the news we have for you for this week. But don't go away, as we welcome you to Grapevine Extra. A few days ago, Desney and Andrew welcomed to the studio a gentleman you may have heard on the BBC. Desney has the details.
Hello everyone. Andrew and I are here today with a very special guest who's come all the way from the BBC in Norwich. And it's Paul Hayes. And I'll let him say a bit more about himself.
Well, hello. Thank you very much for having me. It's a very great pleasure to be here. I don't know if I qualify as a very special guest, but thank you for giving me that lovely introduction. Yes, my name is Paul Hayes, and for nearly 20 years now, I've worked at the BBC in Norwich for BBC Radio Norfolk in various roles as a producer, presenter, tea maker and general dog's body. I've produced various programmes, most notably Treasure Quest, which used to run on Sundays, and I used to produce Matthew Gudgeon's Tea Time programme. And these days I read news in the afternoons and do various other special projects and bits and pieces as and when, and a little archive slot on Fordyce Fredrickson's Saturday show as well.
How did you get started, Paul, in broadcasting? In local radio, should I say?
Well, I had come up to Norfolk to go to the University of East Anglia in Norwich. I'm from Sussex, down on the south coast. And I'd chosen to come to the UEA in Norwich because I came up to see it when I was 18 and it seemed a very nice place to live. I liked the university, I liked the city. So I came and did 3 years there studying English literature, which the old joke is it's the perfect qualification for the dole queue. And of course, the joke about Norwich is, especially UEA students who come to Norwich, there's a joke about it being the graveyard of ambition because so many people come to Norwich to the UEA and stay there afterwards because it's a nice place to stay. Mm-hmm. So I'd stayed in Norwich and I wasn't really sure what to do in life and where I was going to go next. And I was doing a temporary job at the county council, a very boring admin type job in adult social services. But I knew that wasn't how I was going to spend my life. But I'd always been fascinated by broadcasting, always been very interested in broadcasting and broadcasting history, and ended up making inquiries with there was a man called Tim Bishop who used to run the BBC in Norwich. And we'd had a little bit to do with him when I was at university. He'd been a judge in an award category for some awards we'd run at the student TV station. And I wrote to Tim and said, look, how how does one become involved in the BBC? And he very kindly wrote back and said, well, the classic way in is to go in one day a week to answer phones as a volunteer. So I ended up doing that, and I started answering phones on what used to be called the Action Desk at Radio Norfolk. And the Action Desk was various volunteers who would go in one day a week each on different days of the week, and they would deal with all the queries from people. So if someone would phone in and say, oh, you mentioned a book on one of your programmes. It was 3 months ago. I can't remember the author's name or what the book was about or what it was called. Can you tell me what the book was, please? We would deal with all those sorts of queries from listeners. And gradually, I did that for a while. And then gradually, I started picking up page shifts here and there. First of all, working with Keith Skews, who many people will remember on a Sunday night.
Cardboard Shoes, Keith Skews.
Yes, Jambo World. So I picked up various other shifts and bits and pieces. And then eventually, in early 2008, there was a job came up that someone else was stopping doing. And the editor, David Clayton, called me in and he said, well, there's this particular job. We're not sure what we're going to do with this job. We might not carry on that role, but we need someone to do it for 3 months while we decide what we're going to do with it. Would you like to come and work for the BBC full time for 3 months, even though there's no guarantee there'll be anything after that? And I thought, well, this is amazing. I mean, even if it only ends up being 3 months. So I worked for the BBC full time, even just for 3 months. I thought that would be wonderful. And that was in early 2008. And 18 years on, I've been there in various different roles ever since.
You've been getting away with it since.
I know, it is amazing. I felt for a long while as if I cheated my way in, because there was this thing in the BBC. It's probably the case in other industries as well. But there was this thing where if you did the same job for a certain amount of time, I think it was 3 years at this point. I ended up getting a series of 6 month contracts that took me up to 3 years. And if you were doing the same role and you'd done that for 3 years, they had to put you on staff because they couldn't just keep endlessly. There was this regulation that if you'd done it for a certain amount of time, they had to make you staff, which they did with me in the end. So without an interview, or what the BBC calls a board, because it inherits that terminology from the civil service. They don't call it a job interview, they call it a board. Yeah. So without even passing a board, I ended up becoming staff at the BBC, which you're not really supposed to be able to do, and is sort of cheating a bit. So I did feel for a long while that eventually someone in administration somewhere would think, hang on, this isn't right, and they would get rid of me. But luckily that's never happened. I will say, for anyone in BBC administration listening, I have successfully passed the board now for my current role, so you can't get rid of me for that.
That's good. Because, I mean, in Norfolk, being more rural, we're really aware of the role of local radio. How do you see the future?
Well, that's difficult, isn't it? I mean, if I could predict the future of how the media was going to go in this day and age, I would secretly write it all down, run off and form my own company. But it is tricky, isn't it? A lot of the old traditional media that we all grew up with in terms of radio and television and newspapers has been... The media industry is very fractured now, and it works very differently. A lot of people growing up, local radio, once Radio Norfolk started in 1980, it might have been their only source of local news in that way. You would have the local paper and the local radio station, and that would be the only real way you could get local news. Now there's an explosion of different ways to get it, all kinds of different Facebook groups. Social media has become such a huge thing. Lots of people join Facebook groups related to their particular area, and it doesn't just have to be, certainly just a county. It can be even just a town like Yarmouth, but even particular little districts of Yarmouth will have their own, community Facebook groups where people exchange information. Yeah, It's you can get it right down to that sort of level now. So, but of course, with that, you have the whole issue of reliability and accountability, and who is overseeing where that information comes from, and what trust can you place in that information. And of course, with the rise of AI recently, you get all those issues on a big scale. It won't surprise you to know I don't have the answer to any of those questions, but it is certain that the media world is one that is changing very rapidly. Now, I think people will always want information about where they live, their local community, what's going on locally. What format that information will take is one that I think is very difficult to try and predict.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we try in our little way here with Grapevine to keep local news for our listeners, don't we, Desney?
We do, yeah. Yeah.
Now, over the years, there's got to have been a few standout moments for you, Paul. Humorous or otherwise? Have you got a couple of anecdotes for
us? Any funny broadcasting stories? Seeing as how I know he has told this one himself, I will tell this one on Grapevine about my colleague Matthew Gudgeon, who, as I mentioned at the beginning, I used to produce his programme, his Tea Time Show. And we'd been contacted by someone once, an American, I think it was, who'd written a book about Nelson, a great Norfolk boy, of course, a great local boy, Norfolk man, and glories in being so. And so we thought, well, this is a good subject for us. We could talk to this author about his book. And Matthew sent a copy of the book, and he sort of, you can imagine, you get sent so many books and things to read that you don't always get time to read them in any depth before you do the interview. So he'd sort of read the summary, and he'd looked at the first couple of chapters, and he did the interview with this man. man about why he'd wanted to write a book about Nelson and what his hopes were for the book and all this kind of stuff. The interview was all fine, all went out, all normal. And then after the interview had been done and recorded and gone out on the programme, Matthew thought, well, I'll read. He read the book properly. And it wasn't a non-fiction book. It was a fiction book. This man had written a sort of novel about Nelson. And how shall I phrase this? There was a lot of what one might phrase as erotic content in it, as it turned out. Nelson's adventures in this book were not purely of the naval variety. And so Matthew came in and he thought, I've read this book about Nelson, that we've put this in. It's pretty racy, you know. This it was Nelson's erotic adventures through.
Oh, my
so it was I don't know if he would necessarily have done that in quite the same way, perhaps, had he actually read the book in full beforehand.
Right. So all your programs, basically, you have some recorded slots in there, but mostly you're going out live on radio?
In terms of, obviously it depends what the programme is. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I really enjoy doing, actually, is making more of what we might call built programmes in terms of documentaries. That's something I do enjoy working on live radio. I love working on live programmes, that sense of connection you have with the audience and the way you can very quickly respond to things and make things part of the programme. All that's great fun, but I do really enjoy the chance to put something together very carefully and properly in documentary form. And making documentaries is, it's not something we do a lot of in local radio, but I've had the opportunity to do quite a lot of it down the years, even able to carry on doing it now with BBC Sounds, our online service. And I've always loved researching things and looking into things, and there's something really enjoyable about, if you've got a passion for something or you discover something that you think is interesting, the process of finding out about it, researching it, but then making it accessible to someone else. Because if you're passionate about something, or if you find something really interesting, there's a risk you can be a real bore to other people if you really want to tell them all about it. So even if the subject is interesting to you, you have to make your program about it in such a way that it will be of interest to a general audience. And so I really love the idea of putting something out and just having someone think, oh, that's interesting. And that process of taking the information and converting it into a form makes sense and is interesting to and engages other people, whether you're doing that in a little clip for a news bulletin or a little 3-minute package to go in a live program like Chris Gorm at Breakfast or something, or as a whole kind of documentary program. I find that process really fascinating of building something like that and crafting it and putting it together.
Yeah, because I think people think of radio presenters, TV presenters, they just turn up, read what they've got to read and go, but there is so much prep work that goes on before you're on the air.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, I won't deny that down the years I've seen Stuart White stroll up and down the newsroom practicing his golf swing. But no, he would do that once he'd sort of gone through his scripts, and you would see him sort of pace up and down the newsroom practicing his swing.
But way of just relaxing, maybe,
I think so. Yeah, I'm not sure, or just maybe. I never asked him in depth about it, but no, I mean, certainly at the level of broadcasting I operate at, and at most levels of broadcasting within the BBC, really, the presenter will not just do the BBC. BBC used to, years, long time ago, decades ago, they would employ actors to read the news because
of an addiction.
Yes, exactly. So because they were seen as more of kind of a performer, and they wanted someone who could read the news clearly and deliver it clearly and confidently, whereas the news would be written by journalists. And it wasn't really until ITV started that you sort of got the journalist newsreader role, and the BBC began doing that as well. But yes, I mean, the people you see and hear on the BBC will be very actively engaged in what goes into the programme. Obviously, with news bulletins, particularly on the television news, if you see Susie on Look East, it's all very carefully crafted and written, but she's very involved in that process to make sure that she can convey it in the way that is best for her to convey. Because all people who read scripts and read, I mean, you will find it yourselves when you read the news. The two of you, if you had the same story to read, you would each, Andrew Desney, you would tweak it slightly differently to suit your reading style.
Absolutely.
There'd be certain phrases or just certain ways you read different things that you, Desney, would read in a slightly different way to how Andrew would do it. And everyone's like that. So as well as having the sort of basic guidelines of BBC style guides and that kind of thing, everyone who reads something on BBC will have their own little way of, like, if Tim Adicott, our morning newsreader, has written a little script for a news clip that he's passing on to me to read in the afternoon, I will normally sort of tweak it just to suit my reading style more than it does his, and that's just sort of a natural way of doing things.
And if we don't tweak ours too much,
we have to be careful, don't we?
Well, everyone does. I mean, obviously, you suit the kind of style and the rules and regulations and things. But if you feel that you can if you know that the way you read, I'm struggling to think of an example now, but there are certain, we all have, anyone who's ever done much kind of reading out loud, you know that there are certain combinations of words or certain phrases that you know you just can't quite get your mouth around properly. So you might just rewrite it slightly so that you can read it in a more comfortable fashion.
Yeah, we do that probably.
Yeah.
As we go along, basically, don't we? Yeah. I mean, people listening think there's a script and everything else. There's not, you know. It's not.
You just make up the news.
None of it is true. None of it is true. So for you, Paul, broadcasting heroes, anybody you particularly admire?
All kinds of people, really. There's a broadcaster called Anita Anand, who's presented a lot on Five Live and various other places on Radio 4 down the years. And I've always really admired her because she has that great ability to deal with both serious subjects and light-hearted subjects very well. And not everyone is good at doing that. Some people are sort of more serious kind of journalists and are very good at doing the heavier news. But sometimes they might find it more difficult to engage in the kind of more light-hearted subjects and vice versa. But she's always been very good at being able to go between the two. Certainly locally, I've mentioned already Matthew Gudgeon, someone I've worked with for many years, but he is someone I've always very much looked up to all the time I've worked with him, because you never could, you can't throw him. You know, he can deal with anything that happens on the air. And having worked with him a lot in live broadcasting situations on programmes, if something is suddenly happening, I know that he knew that he could deal with it. In many ways, in doing that show with Matthew was always kind of, it was sometimes, and this is going to sound counterintuitive, but it was sometimes more satisfying as a producer to work on it when there was a stand-in presenter, because I knew that they needed my help more. Mm-hmm. They needed more of my assistance to get through the programme. Whereas I knew with Matthew, really, if I kind of dropped down dead behind the producer's desk, he would be able to carry on with the show without any issue. I mean, he might have spared a glance for what happened on the other side of the glass, but I knew he would have had the capacity to carry out.
Yeah. I mean, we mentioned him earlier, Stuart White. Stuart as well always gave me that impression that just absolutely whatever came along, be it hilarious or tragic, Stuart would deal with it in his own.
He's fantastic, Stuart. Yeah. And the extra thing that TV presenters have to deal with, which radio presenters generally don't, is there's this thing in broadcasting called talkback. It's where if you're doing a live programme, the producer or whoever in the production area can talk to you in your ears while you're working. Now, usually in radio, we don't do this while the presenter is talking, because we're not really trained for it in radio. The presenter would suddenly stop in alarm. We tend to do it like while someone else is talking, or while they're in a song, or while they're in a feature or something. But in television presenters, when you see a newsreader looking at you talking, quite often while they're talking and you can hear them speaking on the television news, they are quite often being talked at in their ear while they're reading this script with one part of their brain, and in the other part of their brain, they are concentrating on what's being said to them from the production gallery. Yeah. And that's not unusual. I mean, you can go online, and if you do a search online for TV news with talkback, you'll find all sorts of examples that people have put up down the years where you can hear what's going out on air and you can hear the talkback track at the same time, and you can hear what the presenter's got in their ear while they're trying to read the news. And it's extraordinary. They have this capacity to... So you'll have... Perhaps, so they'll be reading, saying, this is the 1 o'clock news with Philip Hayton and our top story this afternoon. While in their ear, they're being told, we don't have the top story, the satellite truck isn't there, we're going to have to go to the next story, go down to page 7 of your script and read that one. And they're just calmly, serenely... I know this is an overused analogy that everyone... It is the old analogy of the swan, where the legs are kicking away frantically under the water and they're smoothly gliding. But the way that television newsreaders and presenters deal with that, it's absolutely extraordinary how much of a cacophony there can often be going on in their ears while they're working in it. It really is very impressive.
I've heard of it. Do you have the 5-second delay button for phone-ins?
No, we don't. That was never a BBC thing. It was always more of a commercial radio thing. It was the radio authority, the IBA, the Independent Broadcasting Authority. They were always, I think it's partly because the BBC in the early years and decades didn't really do a huge amount of phone-ins. Again, it was something that more happened in the early days. It came from commercial radio, really, and then the BBC sort of followed the example a bit later on. But the IBA that ran commercial radio, they were always very nervous of phone-ins, and so they would have this regulation that they would have to have delays. And so the way it would work in the 70s was that the output would go through tape machine, which created a delay, and so that if there was an unfortunate incident on the air, the presenter had a button they could, I think maybe producer and presenter had one, I'm not sure exactly how it worked, but they would be able to push a button so that when it was going through this delay tape machine, the playhead would lift off the tape, and so you wouldn't hear that bit. And so that did happen, but only in commercial radio. The BBC has always been live is live. If we're saying something's live, then it is live.
Memo to producer here. We might invest in one of those.
So, we're going to come down a bit from posh BBC talk now. Who would you share a bag of chips with on the market, Paul?
Well, it might drag us slightly back to BBC talk, I'm afraid, because it does relate to something I'm hoping to work on later in the year. So living or dead, any person sharing a bag of chips in Yarmouth Market, it would be, and you'll probably roll your eyes at this, Desney, because you know about certain interests I have, but I'll explain why. It would be the actor Patrick Troughton, who was the second Doctor in Doctor Who. Because I'm hoping later this year to make a little BBC Sounds documentary series about Patrick Troughton, because he spent most of the Second World War based in Great Yarmouth.
Oh, did he?
Yes, he did. Yes, he was in the Royal Navy, and he was based with the force that they had stationed in Yarmouth. He had two roles. The first role he was part of was they would intercept the German E-boats, the motor torpedo boats, that would attack the convoys going up and down the North Sea. And there was a Royal Naval base in Yarmouth where they would get the alerts, and they would have to go out and tackle these German E-boats in the North Sea. And he did that for about sort of half his time in Yarmouth, two or three years, I think. But then he was switched to another role based in Yarmouth, doing search and rescue for downed pilots who'd bailed out and had landed in the drink in the North Sea. They would go out from Yarmouth and rescue these pilots and fish out. And he much preferred doing that because it was a life-saving role rather than what was frankly, you know, killing role in the one that
exactly.
He'd been in.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was, you know, defending convoys, it was still having to attack and the people in these boats. It's funny to think, isn't it, about being based in Yarmouth, but being right on the front line of the war, which obviously Yarmouth was in many respects in both wars, as we know. It was bombed and shelled in the First World War, and then right on the line of convoy defence of the North Sea in the Second World War. But because of the nature of it, one of the fascinating things about, well, there's many fascinating things about Troughton's time in Yarmouth. I mean, he fell in love with Norfolk while he was living here, and years later he had a cottage for many years on the Broads, a holiday home on the Broads. But also, so he's stationed here in Yarmouth during the Second World War. He's right on the front line. He's seeing action night after night after night. But because it's Yarmouth, he's in this rare situation of being in active service in the Navy on the front line. But his wife's here living with him in Yarmouth. So it's one of the few places where you're sort of on active service with the Navy, but you can go home and live with your wife. So it's just such a fascinating contrast. So I did a little bit about it a couple of years ago when it was Doctor Who's 60th anniversary. I made a little piece where I spoke to one of his sons, Michael Troughton, who lives in Suffolk, and he's written a biography of his father. And so I recorded an interview with Michael, recorded much more than we could really use in that little piece. So I asked Michael, because later this year it's going to be the 60th anniversary of Troughton becoming the Doctor in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So I thought it would be nice sort of time with that, maybe do a little, perhaps maybe three-part series on BBC Sounds, our online service, because we have the little secret Norfolk section of BBC Sounds where we put up little stories about Norfolk and little mini documentaries and things. So I thought, I've got this interview with Mike, asked if he'd mind if I used more of it in this, and he said no, that was fine. And my hope is that maybe we can speak to, so I haven't quite got it all planned out yet because I'm working on something else at the moment, and this will be for a bit later in the year, but I'm hoping to maybe talk to someone maybe about Royal Naval history, so we can hear a bit more about the Navy in Yarmouth during the Second World War, and someone about Yarmouth history in terms of, you know, what it was like in Yarmouth during that time, during the Second World War, and hopefully it'll make a nice little program. But yeah, it was such a fascinating experience to be in Yarmouth in the Second World War, and you're right on the front line and going out and seeing action every night, but then coming home and living with your wife in a house in Yarmouth.
So
it'd be fascinating to have been able to get his memories of that time.
So, I mean, he's obviously, as the Doctor, well before your time, Paul.
Yeah.
But your favourite Doctor then?
I love them all. I mean, it's a cheat answer to say, but I'm a big Doctor Who fan.
To love them all, really?
Yeah, but I do. I genuinely do. There's something I can find to enjoy in all of them. I mean, there are various ones that I really enjoy. I mean, Troughton is obviously very good. William Hartnell, just the sense of being the first and being original, and just the magic of that of being those early years and the very beginning of it all.
Oh, blimey, yes. I certainly remember the very first days of it, and definitely behind the sofa. Too,
with
the Daleks.
Yes, like, you were there watching the day after Kennedy's assassination, were you?
Yes, indeed.
Yes,
Yes, indeed.
But I find something to love in all
but
of them.
But you go with it the way it's going, You know,
I mean, I always make the analogy that being a fan of anything really is you stay with it through thick and thin, through everything. So it is like being a football fan. It's like being a fan of the Canaries. This is something that grabbed you by the soul when you were little, when you were a tiny child, and you just really love it for reasons that you can't adequately explain. And it's like if Norwich lose 5-0, loads of people say this is the worst they've ever been. Absolutely. They might as well shut the team down. I'm not going next week. Yep. I'm never going ever again. And they're still there next week, and for all the weeks after.
All the lights on Canary Call.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you listen in to Canary Call, Des?
Oh, yes.
You've probably called in, I imagine, haven't you, in the park? No, not Canary Call.
Oh, right.
But even because you know that even if it's not particularly good one week, it is your team, it is your passion, it is your interest, and there will always be future times and future weeks. So, the Doctor Who has its up and downs down the years, but it's just something that's really sort of part of me, and I can't imagine ever not wanting to watch it when it's on.
There's a guy who lives in Norwich who did a lot of illustrations for it, a book, and I can't remember his name now. Absolutely marvellous. I think I found him through Grapevine. I can't remember how it was. And my son-in-law is a massive fan, and I went round to his house and got one of his books signed, and they're pen and ink drawings.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely superb.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. There is obviously still a big market, and obviously with the comic cons that go on which we have at Yarmouth.
Yeah. Well, and for a plug as well, there is a big market, and hopefully some of that market will be buying in March my BBC audiobook, Starflight, read by Christopher Naylor, which is a brand new story for the First Doctor, Ian, Barbara and Susan. So that's out in early March. So, order now, order often.
Wow, well, there you go. That's what all these interviews are about. It's why he's here, to get a book plug in, really. An audio book plug.
Oh, he's got books.
Oh, yes, yes.
He's a writer.
Oh, I'm an author, don't you know?
On what subject?
Well, on Doctor Who mainly, yes. And, well, I did write a book. Ever since I was tiny, the only thing I've ever wanted to be is a writer. Occasionally when I was a child, this was accompanied by other ambitions. Like I wanted to be a fireman and a writer, or a Formula One race car designer and a writer. but it's always been, I love writing. I talked about that thing about how, I love, it's all about telling stories, really. It's conveying stories. Even when you're doing nonfiction, you're doing documentaries, it's all about forming that narrative and conveying it to someone else and hopefully engaging them with it. And as a little child, I loved writing stories. At school, I loved writing stories. And I've always wanted to be a novelist. I haven't really succeeded in that yet. I've written some nonfiction. I wrote a book a few years ago about the Treasure Quest show that I used to produce, and we raised some money for children in need with that. And I've written a couple of books about Doctor Who. I've got another book coming out later this year about some sort of early television history, which Desney very kindly read for me as someone who was a child in the 1950s at the time I was writing about in the book. I thought, because Desney often emails me about the radio programmes and things on the radio, and so we built up this sort of correspondence down the years. And so as I'd written this book about 1950s children's television, I thought, well, I know someone who was a child in the 1950s. So I asked her if she'd read it for me, and she very kindly read it for me and pointed out some of the mistakes I'd made, which was helpful. But I love writing. I've always wanted to be a novelist. I find writing fiction much harder than writing nonfiction. With nonfiction, I can look at it and see what's wrong with it and see what needs fixing, and I know how to get X, Y, and Z. I find writing fiction much more difficult.
So literary heroes, then?
Oh, literary heroes. Well, I mean, someone I've always very much admired has been George Orwell. Oddly enough, even though he's very famous as a very political writer, I think he's at his best when he's not being political as such, like when he's telling stories. Like there's a very famous essay of his called A Hanging, where he describes when he was working as a military policeman in Burma in the 1920s, and he witnessed a hanging. And there's this great bit in that where, I won't get the words exactly, I was paraphrasing it, but he talks about watching this man being led to the scaffold and how the man steps around a puddle in the path. It's that whole kind of thing about how, what's the point, you know?
Yes, yeah,
but it's just the way he kind of wrote it.
Yes.
And just those little kind of observations like that. And how after the hanging, it had such an effect on everyone that the colonial officials and the Burmese policemen, they all sort of talked and spoke together as, for that one moment, they were kind of all as equals. They're all speaking together as equals after they witnessed, I think Orwell phrases it as, the destruction of a human being. And for that brief moment, it kind of affected them all so much that they just kind of talked and spoke together as equals before the whole, structures of colonialism then came back in. But it's just an example of, of how great he is at kind of observing and conveying the intricacies of life.
Yeah, certainly underrated, I think, as well. I'm sure lots of us can remember him from school days.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Animal Farm, etc.
Yeah, Animal Farm.
Those are the two big ones. Obviously, Animal Farm in 1984. Yes.
And shame to say, I've not revisited either since those, which maybe should be read again.
Yeah, well, of course, they're much more accessible now, of course, because he has gone out of copyright now, because he died in, when was it? It was January 1950, wasn't it? Yeah, so beginning of 2021, he went out of copyright. So that's why there's been lots of more kind of adaptations and things of 1984 recently, because it's in the public domain now. So people, and there's another Animal Farm, I think, either just come out or it's just coming out.
That's right, there is. Yeah.
Because again, it's all in the public domain now, so people can do with it what they want to.
Well, we can't do Desert Island Discs in full, Paul, but if you could choose a piece of music, what would you have and why would it be special to you?
That's tricky, isn't it? It's I struggle over this one thinking about it, because there's all sorts of things you could pick, from a favourite band or something that strikes a chord with a particular time in my life, because of various things that we've been talking about, things I'm interested in. I thought I would mention a wonderful piece of music, well, wonderful being the operative word, piece of music by The Shadows that I really like, Wonderful Land, which this is going to sound odd as well, but this is going to sound very weird, but there's something about, I enjoy about a certain sense of melancholy, that sense of kind of nostalgic kind of yearning for something you have never really had and could never really have. And I find that whole era of the early 1960s fascinating. So I wrote a book called Pull to Open, which was all about the creation of Doctor Who in 1963. But one of the things that I wanted to do with that book was implant it in the kind of cultural era as well. And that year I find fascinating, that era of That Was the Week That Was and Zed Cars, Kennedy and Profumo.
Absolutely.
And it's just such a kind of melting pot of a year and an era.
Which is, really interesting to hear you say that, because you weren't around. No. Desley and I can relate to it.
I really love that book.
So many
it's
of our
so
listeners.
So many memories in there.
Yeah, so many of our listeners will have been young children in the early 60s. So we kind of were, all this was coming to us.
I mean, I realise there is a danger of people, particularly people like me, looking back, that there is a danger of mythologising these eras. Whereas, obviously, people didn't wake up in 1st of January 1960. Oh, it's 1st of January 1963. What a great year we're going to have. It's going to be so interesting. Yeah. Obviously, people, they weren't living kind of you weren't living in a nostalgic black and white world. You were living in a full colour world with all the kind of hopes and concerns and troubles and worries that anyone else has. But obviously, as the years go by, all that kind of wears away. It's like a stone getting worn away in the sea and becoming smoothed down. What kind of survives are the kind of narratives and the stories, the space race and all that kind of thing. And
first heart transplant.
That whole era of the 60s, yes. And as I say, even though there's a danger of mythologizing it, and there were people who were very bored and very unhappy at that time, and not everyone was, thinking what a great time it was to be alive. But I do find it just culturally and socially a really fascinating time period. And I know this has gone off track a bit from the music, but Wonderful Land, I just think it's got a wonderful, it's a I better not, because you have to pay PRS if I do too much.
Yeah, that's right.
But and it has that sense of kind of, of that kind of lost world just over the horizon as the sun's going down.
Yes.
I love that kind of, I know it sounds weird to say I like that melancholy feeling, but there is something about it that really appeals to me.
Well, in our extensive library of discs that we keep here at Grapevine, I know Graham will be able to find that without a shadow of a doubt. Pardon the pun, without a shadow of a doubt. But great times.
Well, F1, you were telling us, that's
Formula
your interest.
One, yes.
Tell us something about your other interests.
Oh, well,
and that one,
Yes, no.
All of it.
Formula One motor racing has always been a great passion of mine as well. And I've been lucky. Again, this is one of the great things about, I've been so lucky in my life in that through working at the BBC, being very lucky to get in at the BBC at the right time, I've been able to work and do projects about things I'm interested in, which is such a great thing to be able to do. So I've been able to make little bits and programmes, things about Doctor Who and about the Beatles and broadcasting history and all kinds of different things. And I had the opportunity, we had for a little while, we had our own Formula One show that we both did radio, because there's a lady called Rosanna Tennant who works on a lot of the Formula One broadcasting, and she lives in Norfolk and goes to most of the Formula One races, and she did a little sort of Formula One show with us. And we got the opportunity to do a visit to the Williams Formula One factory in Oxfordshire, and Rosanna wasn't able to go, so I went and did the feature, and we saw one of George Russell's Formula One cars, obviously George Russell, and, well, sort of Norfolk, but he's from sort of the Wisbeachy area, he's on the border, Norfolk, Cambridgeshire. We like to claim him for, we always say Kings Lynn-born George
That's
Russell
right. yes,
when we're
yeah.
talking about
just
him.
On, yeah. Just inside.
Yes. I remember once someone on our Facebook page commented that just because you have a maternity unit doesn't mean you claim someone's soul. But we always claim him as Kings Lynn's George Russell. But so we saw one of his cars there, and we did this whole feature about it. And that's the kind of thing that I never would have, when I was sort of a 11-year-old boy watching Formula One on the television, I never would have imagined that I'd be able to go to the Williams factory and do something like that. I realised there's a danger, especially when you're working on the public payroll, there's a danger of sounding very kind of self-indulgent about these things, and as if you're just having a jolly time, you know, enjoying yourself. And I am in a hugely privileged position. I have a job where, even though it has its frustrations and annoyances like any other job does from time to time, I'm in that hugely privileged position where I don't wake up in the morning and think, oh, I've got to go to work today, which is, you can't really put a price on that. You can't put a value on that. But I hope, and I do always try and consciously keep in mind that I am on the public payroll. I am doing this for the licence fee payer. I'm not there just to have a good time. But I hope that when I'm making think programmes or features or things about things I'm interested in, I hope that the effort I put in makes them of interest to other people too.
Exactly what it does.
Yeah, well, if
your enthusiasm is
exactly,
infectious.
I was going to say it's bubbling over here. There's no question, and you know we could go on all day. Paul, it's been an absolute privilege for us to have you here in the studio, and we can only say thank you very much, can't we, Daphne?
Yeah, that's all we can say. Well, I'm always saying it to Paul for all the things he does.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and thank you for the tea as well.
You're very welcome, Paul Hayes. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, that's all we have for you this week. Grapevine is copyright 2026 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. Next week, Your newsreaders will be Desney and Alison. So, we look forward to your company for that. But in the meantime, we wish you a good week and hope you stay safe and well. So from all your friends at Grapevine, it's as usual, bye for now.